Welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I think you'll find today's show a very different kind of literary diversion. The glory of audiobooks takes center stage with classic titles recently performed by some of Hollywood's top actors. Colin Firth, who narrates one of today's selections, comments, "Theater and film each offer their own challenges and rewards, but narration provides exhilarating possibilities for both actors and listeners. It offers me the opportunity to perform and to engage with so many who share my passion for storytelling." Indeed! We'll also be previewing a book many of us have been waiting for, Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman. Maria Mills, who spent 18 months living next door to Harper Lee, stops by to speak about the experience. So let's jump right in as we turn to page one of the book report. Originally written in the mid-1950s, Go Set a Watchman was the novel Harper Lee first submitted to her publishers before To Kill a Mockingbird. Assumed to have been lost, the manuscript was discovered in late 2014. Go Set a Watchman features many of the characters from To Kill a Mockingbird some 20 years later. Returning home to Macomb to visit her father, Jean Louise Finch, Scout, struggles with issues both personal and political, involving Atticus and the small Alabama town that shaped her. Reese Witherspoon delivers a stirring performance.
When she was starting on her fourth cup of coffee, the Crescent Limited honked like a giant goose at its northbound mate and rumbled across the Chattahoochee into Alabama. The Chattahoochee is wide, flat, and muddy. It was low today. A yellow sandbar had reduced its flow to a trickle. "Perhaps it sings in the wintertime," she thought. "I do not remember a line of that poem. Piping down the valleys wild? No. Did he write to a waterfowl, or was it a waterfall?" She sternly repressed a tendency to boisterousness when she reflected that Sidney Lanier must have been somewhat like her long-departed cousin, Joshua Singleton St. Clair, whose private literary preserves stretched from the Black Belt to Bayou La Batterie. Jean Louise's aunt often held up Cousin Joshua to her as a family example not lightly to be discountenanced. He was a splendid figure of a man. He was a poet. He was cut off in his prime. And Jean Louise would do well to remember that he was a credit to the family. His pictures did the family well. Cousin Joshua looked like a ratty Algernon Swinburne. Jean Louise smiled to herself when she remembered her father telling her the rest of it. Cousin Joshua was cut off, all right. Not by the hand of God, but by Caesar's hosts. When at the university, Cousin Joshua studied too hard and thought too much. In fact, he read himself straight out of the 19th century. He affected an Inverness cape and wore jackboots he had a blacksmith make up from his own design. Cousin Joshua was frustrated by the authorities when he fired upon the president of the university, who in his opinion was little more than a sewage disposal expert. This was no doubt true, but an idle excuse for assault with a deadly weapon. After much passing around of money, Cousin Joshua was moved across the tracks and placed in state accommodations for the irresponsible, where he remained for the rest of his days. They said he was reasonable in every respect until someone mentioned that president's name. Then his face would become distorted. He would assume a whooping crane attitude and hold it for 8 hours or more, and nothing or nobody could make him lower his leg until he forgot about that man. On clear days, Cousin Joshua read Greek, and he left a thin volume of verse printed privately by a firm in Tuscaloosa. The poetry was so ahead of its time, no one has deciphered it yet. But Jean Louise's aunt keeps it displayed casually and prominently on a table in the living room. Jean Louise laughed aloud, then looked around to see if anyone had heard her. Her father had a way of undermining his sister's lectures on the innate superiority of any given Finch. He always told his daughter the rest of it, quietly and solemnly, but Jean Louise sometimes thought she detected an unmistakably profane glint in Atticus Finch's eyes. Or was it merely the light hitting his glasses? She never knew. The countryside and the train had subsided to a gentle roll, and she could see nothing but pasture land and black cows from window to horizon. She wondered why she had never thought her country beautiful. The station at Montgomery nestled in an elbow of the Alabama, and when she got off the train to stretch her legs, the returning familiar with its drabness, lights, and curious odors rose to meet her. "There's something missing," she thought. "Hot boxes, that's it." A man goes along under the train with a crowbar. There is a clank, and then tss, tss, tss. White smoke comes up, and you think you're inside a chafing dish. These things run on oil now. For no reason, an ancient fear gnawed her. She had not been in this station for 20 years, but when she was a child and went to the capital with Atticus, she was terrified lest the swaying train plunge down the riverbank and drown them all. But when she boarded again for home, she forgot. The train clacketed through pine forests and honked derisively at a gaily painted bell-funneled museum piece sidetracked in a clearing. It bore the sign of a lumber concern, and the Crescent Limited could have swallowed it whole with room to spare. Greenville, Evergreen, Macomb Junction.
We've just heard Go Set a Watchman by Harper Lee. Maria Mills is a former reporter for the Chicago Tribune and a member of an investigative team at the paper who won a Pulitzer Prize for a series about O'Hare Airport. Maria was born and raised in Madison, Wisconsin. She's a graduate of Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. Today we'll speak with Maria about The Mockingbird Next Door, Life with Harper Lee. It's just out in paperback, time to coincide with the publication of Harper Lee's much-anticipated title, Go Set a Watchman. Welcome, Maria. It's wonderful to have you with us on the Book Report.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What brought you to Monroeville, Alabama for the first time?
Well, I think I have the Chicago Library System to thank for that. I was a feature writer at the Chicago Tribune when in 2001 the library system in Chicago selected To Kill a Mockingbird for its first ever one book, one Chicago community read. And so not long after, an editor came to my desk and said, "Want to take a trip?" I said, "Sure, where to?" And when he said Monroeville, Alabama, I think he saw my quizzical look, but explained that that was Harper Lee's hometown. And so the idea was for readers in Chicago, with so much attention on the book, we knew that Nell Harper Lee, her given name, and Alice Finchley, her sister and attorney, were private, didn't expect to meet either of them, but thought it would be interesting for readers to know more about this hometown that produced both her and her childhood playmate, Truman Capote. And so it was a surprise and a delight when that visit ended up in a meeting with both of them.
Why do you think, as such intensely private people, they let you in where hundreds of others had failed?
Well, I think initially they were interested in knowing more about what was happening in Chicago with that program. They'd always been great supporters of libraries. And I had written Alice Lee to let her know that I'd be in town and why. And I think that simple courtesy even maybe played a role. I spoke with Alice Lee first, knocked on the door of that modest red brick house they shared all those years, and was surprised when this wisp of a woman answered the door and invited me in. And there was a kind of rapport there from the beginning. And then it was shortly after that I had my phone ring at the room in the Best Western Motel where I was staying, and that was Nell Harper Lee calling to see about arranging coming by my room the next day. And so that was the first time I spoke with her. And she was down to earth from the start, and did want to know more about what was happening in Chicago. When I told her that among the things that had been screened was a documentary about the making of the movie, which of course came out in 1962, not long after the book, and I told her I'd enjoyed Gregory Peck's remarks about the filming of the movie. And at the mention of his name, I remember her kind of leaning forward and saying, "Isn't he delicious?" And so it was a different kind of encounter than I expected, I would say, even that first time. And of course, as I got to know them better over time, it was just such a privilege to spend time with them and learn more about what it had meant to deal with the success of that book from the start. And all those years later, it's been, of course, more than 50 years now since the book has been out, and the good and the bad, I think, that came for both of them with that just phenomenal success.
How did the sisters spend their days when you first met them? And tell us a little bit more about Alice.
Well, Alice Finchley, I loved that her sister called her Atticus in a skirt, which she most certainly was. She had practiced law with their father, who was, of course, the inspiration for the Atticus Finch character in To Kill a Mockingbird, and very much played that role. She had handled her sister's affairs for years and years, served as gatekeeper, and they were quite different in personality. I thought one of the things that was fascinating was here they were so entwined in their lives, so entwined in the sense that both were dealing with this business of being Harper Lee all those years later and sharing that home in Monroeville when Harper was not in New York. And yet their personalities were so different. I would say Alice was much more the kind of steady, responsible older sister. Nell was more the kind of spirited, spontaneous younger sister. So it was just fascinating to see how they interacted.
Atticus was based on Harper's father, A.C. Lee. Harper's mom was emotionally disturbed. Might that be why Harper created Scout and Jem as motherless children?
Well, you know, one of the things they both talked to me about was their mother and their resentment about the way she had been portrayed, particularly in some of the stories that Truman Capote would tell. He, of course, had spent a good deal of time in their household when he and Nell were just childhood playmates. Amazing to think of those two imaginations together at such an early age. In fact, Alice said she could remember that their father, at the end of the day, would have to say, "Has anyone put Truman out?" he liked to spend time underfoot. And they felt that, he'd had terribly unkind and untrue things to say about their mother. Alice Lee, in particular, felt that she had been, talked in detail about the nervous breakdown that their mother did suffer after their other sister, Louise, as an infant, suffered what we would call failure to thrive now, probably, as an infant, but said that she had sought treatment and had made a good recovery. They both described her as a gentle soul who was a musician and loved crosswords, as they did later in life. So I know they felt that their mother had been mischaracterized.
We're speaking with Maria Mills on the Book Report. Right. Do you think Truman Capote had a big hand in bringing Harper Lee to New York?
Well, I think he was quite helpful to her, just as she was helpful to him when later they traveled to Kansas together to research what became his nonfiction In Cold Blood.
Well, of course, now everyone is talking about Go Set a Watchman. I have a two-part question. Why did Harper not write more books after the phenomenal success of To Kill a Mockingbird? And what motivates her now to publish Go Set a Watchman?
Well, the first one distinction I would make when it comes to that question, so many people, of course, have, why didn't she write more, is that there's a distinction between publishing and writing. And up until now, she hadn't published another book, but she certainly had worked on different things. She worked in the 80s, spent the better part of a year living in Alexander City, Alabama, researching what would have been her own nonfiction book about a series of suspicious killings in that area related to a local minister. She had talked about other novels. She was a great writer of letters, sort of practitioner of that old-fashioned art of correspondence, and I think probably a lot of her life story has maybe been told over the years in these letters that she wrote to different people. So she was writing, even though she wasn't publishing. When I asked her sister about that, she said, "How would you feel?" Her sister, who of course was there as a much older sister to witness all of this, and said, "You know, how would you?" I'm paraphrasing, but how would you feel if you started at the pinnacle? Would you feel you were competing? And as you know, there have been questions surrounding the circumstances under which Gossetta Watchman has come to light and now is being published. She had a serious stroke in 2007, hasn't been able to live at home since then. So I think there are questions surrounding that. As I've talked to readers on this tour for the paperback, I mean, so often they express kind of dueling senses of this, that they're excited to have the prospect of more of Harper Lee's beautiful prose to read and excited to know more about these characters that they feel they know so well, Scout and Atticus and others in To Kill a Mockingbird, but also some hesitation about those circumstances and at her age and in her condition.
Right. Well, Maria, we are all looking forward to the book, and I want to thank you so much for stopping by today to speak with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Alrighty. Bye now.
Bye.
To hear a sampling of The Mockingbird Next Door, check bookreportradio.com, archived shows, week of October 11th, 2014. And if you want to reacquaint yourself with the classic before or after you listen to Gossetta Watchman, why not choose To Kill a Mockingbird, performed by Sissy Spacek? Harper Lee's Pulitzer Prize-winning masterwork is one of the most beloved stories of all times. You'll enjoy hearing it again.
Simon would have regarded with impotent fury the disturbance between the North and the South as it left his descendants stripped of everything but their land. Yet the tradition of living on the land remained unbroken until well into the 20th century, when my father, Atticus Finch, went to Montgomery to read law, and his younger brother went to Boston to study medicine. Their sister, Alexandra, was the Finch who remained at the landing. She married a taciturn man who spent most of his time lying in a hammock by the river, wondering if his trot lines were full. When my father was admitted to the bar, he returned to Macomb and began his practice. Macomb, some 20 miles east of Finch's Landing, was the county seat of Macomb County. Atticus's office in the courthouse contained little more than a hat rack, a spittoon, a checkerboard, and an unsullied Code of Alabama. His first two clients were the last two persons hanged in the Macomb County jail. Atticus had urged them to accept the state's generosity in allowing them to plead guilty to second-degree murder and escape with their lives, but they were Haverfords, in Macomb County, a name synonymous with jackass. The Haverfords had dispatched Macomb's leading blacksmith in a misunderstanding arising from the alleged wrongful detention of a mayor, were imprudent enough to do it in the presence of three witnesses, and insisted that the son of a bitch had it coming to him was a good enough defense for anybody. They persisted in pleading not guilty to first-degree murder, so there was nothing much Atticus could do for his clients except be present at their departure, an occasion that was probably the beginning of my father's profound distaste for the practice of criminal law. During his first 5 years in Macomb, Atticus practiced economy more than anything. For several years thereafter, he invested his earnings in his brother's education. John Hale Finch was 10 years younger than my father and chose to study medicine at a time when cotton was not worth growing. But after getting Uncle Jack started, Atticus derived a reasonable income from the law. He liked Macomb. He was Macomb County born and bred. He knew his people, they knew him, and because of Simon Finch's industry, Atticus was related by blood or marriage, to nearly every family in the town. Macon was an old town, but it was a tired old town when I first knew it. In rainy weather, the streets turned a red slop. Grass grew on the sidewalks. The courthouse sagged in the square. Somehow, it was hotter then. A black dog suffered on a summer's day. Bony mules hitched to Hoover carts flicked flies in the sweltering shade of the live oaks on the square. Men's stiff collars wilted by 9 in the morning. Ladies bathed before noon, after their 3 o'clock naps, and by nightfall were like soft tea cakes with frostings of sweat and sweet talcum. People moved slowly then. They ambled across the square, shuffled in and out of the stores around it, took their time about everything. A day was 24 hours long, but seemed longer. There was no hurry, for there was nowhere to go. Nothing to buy, and no money to buy it with. Nothing to see outside the boundaries of Macon County. But it was a time of vague optimism for some of the people. Macon County had recently been told that it had nothing to fear but fear itself.
That was To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. Distinguished actress Susan Sarandon offers up another classic of the American South in Carson McCullers' The Member of the Wedding. Rarely has emotional turbulence been so delicately conveyed, said the New York Times of McCullers' portrayal of Frankie Adams, a disconnected 12-year-old whose only friends are her family's maid and a 6-year-old cousin. Desperate to be part of something big, she takes an overlarge interest in her brother's wedding and dreams of following the couple on their honeymoon to Alaska. But as Frankie crosses into adulthood, she experiences the fantasy-shattering disillusionment that must come with it.
Big Mama lay in the bed against the wall next to the door, so that in the daytime she could look out through the front window onto the ferny porch and street outside. She was an old colored woman, shriveled and with bones like broomsticks. On the left side of her face and neck, the skin was the color of tallow, so that part of her face was almost white, and the rest copper-colored. The old Frankie used to think that Big Mama was slowly turning to a white person, but Bernice had said it was a skin disease that sometimes happens to colored people. Big Mama had done fancy washing and fluted curtains until the year the misery had stiffened her back so that she took to bed. But she had not lost any faculties. Instead, she suddenly found second sight. The old Frankie had always thought she was uncanny, and when she was a little girl, Big Mama was connected in her mind with the three ghosts who lived inside the coal house. And even now, a child no longer, she still had an eerie feeling about Big Mama. She was lying on three feathered pillows, the covers of which were bordered with crochet, and over her bony legs there was a many-colored quilt. The parlor table with the lamp was pulled up close beside the bed so that she could reach the objects on it. A dream book, a white saucer, a work basket, a jelly glass of water, a Bible, and other things. Big Mama had been talking to herself before F. Jasmine came in, as she had the constant habit of telling herself just who she was and what she was doing and what she intended to do as she lay there in the bed. There were three mirrors on the wall, which reflected the wave-like light from the lamp that fluttered gold-gray in the room and cast giant shadows. The lamp wick needed trimming. Someone was walking in the back room. "I came to get my fortune told," F. Jasmine said. While Big Mama talked to herself when alone, she could be very silent at other times. She stared at F. Jasmine for several seconds before she answered, "Very well. Draw up that stool before the organ." F. Jasmine brought the stool close to the bed and, leaning forward, stretched out her palm. But Big Mama did not take her palm. She examined F. Jasmine's face, then spat the wad of snuff into a chamber pot which she pulled from underneath the bed, and finally put on her glasses. She waited so long that it occurred to F. Jasmine that she was trying to read her mind, and this made her uneasy. The walking in the back room stopped, and there was no sound in the house. "Cast back your mind and remember," she said finally. "Tell me the revelation of your last dream." F. Jasmine tried to cast back her mind, but she did not dream often. Then finally she remembered a dream she had had that summer. "I dreamed there was a door," she said. "I was just looking at it, and while I watched, it began slowly to open, and it made me feel funny, and I woke up." "Was there a hand in the dream?" F. Jasmine thought. "I don't think so." "Was there a cockroach on that door?" "Why, I don't think so." "It signifies as follows." Big Mama slowly closed and opened her eyes. "There's gonna be a change in your life." Next, she took F. Jasmine's palm and studied it for quite a while. "I see here where you're gonna marry a boy with blue eyes and light hair. You will live to be your 70, but you must act careful about water. I see here a red clay ditch and a bale of cotton." F. Jasmine thought to herself that there was nothing to it, only a pure waste of money and time. "What does that signify?" But suddenly the old woman raised her head, and the cords of her neck stiffened, and she called, "You Satan!" She was looking at the wall between the parlor and the kitchen, and F. Jasmine turned to look over her shoulder also. "Yes'm," a voice replied from the back room, and it sounded like Honey.
"How many times I gotta tell you, take them big feet off the kitchen table?"
"Yes'm," Honey said again. His voice was meek as Moses, and F. Jasmine could hear him put his feet down on the floor.
That was The Member of the Wedding by Carson McCullers. Academy Award winner Dustin Hoffman gives a memorable performance in Being There, Jerzy Kosinski's satiric look at the unreality of American media culture. The Audio Publishers Association honored his performance with an Audi Award nomination for Best Solo Narration. Chance, the enigmatic gardener, becomes Chauncey Gardner after getting hit by a limo belonging to a Wall Street tycoon. The whirlwind that follows brings Chance to his new status of political policy advisor and possible vice presidential candidate. His garden variety political responses, inspired by TV, become heralded as visionary, and soon he is a media icon. Of course, Being There was adapted into an Academy Award-winning film starring Peter Sellers.
Chance began walking the three flights upstairs. He did not trust the elevator since the time Black Louise had been trapped in it for hours. He walked down the long corridor until he reached the front of the house. The last time he had seen this part of the house, some of the trees in the garden, now tall and lofty, had been quite small and insignificant. There was no TV then. Catching sight of his reflection in the large hall mirror, Chance saw the image of himself as a small boy, and then the image of the old man sitting in a huge chair. His hair was gray, his hands wrinkled and shriveled. The old man breathed heavily and had to pause frequently between words. Chance walked through the rooms, which seemed empty. The heavily curtained windows barely admitted the daylight. Slowly he looked at the large pieces of furniture shrouded in old linen covers and at the veiled mirrors. The words that the old man had spoken to him the first time had wormed their way into his memory like firm roots. Chance was an orphan, and it was the old man himself who had sheltered him in the house ever since Chance was a child. Chance's mother had died when he was born. No one, not even the old man, would tell him who his father was. While some could learn to read and write, Chance would never be able to manage this. Nor would he ever be able to understand much of what others were saying to him or around him. Chance was to work in the garden where he would care for plants and grasses and trees which grew there peacefully. He would be as one of them, quiet, open-hearted in the sunshine, and heavy when it rained. His name was Chance because he had been born by chance. He had no family. Although his mother had been very pretty, her mind had been as damaged as his. The soft soil of his brain, the ground from which all his thoughts shot up, had been ruined forever. Therefore, he could not look for a place in the life led by people outside the house or the garden gate. Chance must limit his life to his quarters and to the garden. He must not enter other parts of the household or walk out into the street. His food would always be brought to his room by Louise, who would be the only person to see Chance and talk to him. No one else was allowed to enter Chance's room. Only the old man himself might walk and sit in the garden. Chance would do exactly what he was told, or else he would be sent to a special home for the insane, where the old man said he would be locked in a cell and forgotten. Chance did what he was told.
That was a sampling of Being There by Jerzy Kosinski. The horror. Iconic words from Joseph Conrad's brooding and celebrated novella of 1902, Heart of Darkness. Kenneth Branagh performs the tale as if he's telling a ghost story by a campfire, capturing the story's sense of claustrophobia while hinting at the storyteller Marlowe's own creeping madness. The story begins as seaman Charles Marlowe cruises quietly down the Thames at dusk with his friends. As night begins to fall, he tells them of his harrowing journey down an African river in search of the unscrupulous and near legendary ivory trader named Kurtz, a quest that drags him deep into spiritual and symbolic darkness.
We looked at the venerable stream, not in the vivid flush of a short day that comes and departs forever, but in the august light of abiding memories. And indeed, nothing is easier for a man who has, as the phrase goes, followed the sea with reverence and affection than to evoke the great spirit of the past upon the lower reaches of the Thames. The tidal current runs to and fro in its unceasing service, crowded with memories of men and ships it had borne to the rest of home or to the battles of the sea. It had known and served all the men of whom the nation is proud, from Sir Francis Drake to Sir John Franklin, knights all, titled and untitled, the great knights errant of the sea. It had borne all the ships whose names are like jewels flashing in the night of time, from the Golden Hind, returning with her round flanks full of treasure to be visited by the Queen's Highness and thus pass out of the gigantic tale, to the Erebus and Terror, bound on other conquests, and that never returned. It had known the ships and the men. They sailed from Deptford, from Greenwich, from Erith, the adventurers and the settlers, kingships and the ships of men on change, captains, admirals, the dark interlopers of the eastern trade, and the commissioned generals of East India fleets, hunters for gold or pursuers of fame. They all had gone out on that stream, bearing the sword and often the torch, messengers of the might within the land, bearers of a spark from the sacred fire. What greatness had not floated on the ebb of that river into the mystery of an unknown earth? The dreams of men, the seed of commonwealths, the germs of empires. The sun set. The dusk fell on the stream, and lights began to appear along the shore. The Chapman Lighthouse, a three-legged thing erect on a mudflat, shone strongly. Lights of ships moved in the fairway, a great stir of lights going up and going down. And further west, on the upper reaches, the place of the monstrous town was still marked ominously on the sky, a brooding gloom in sunshine, a lurid glare under the stars. "And this also," said Marlowe suddenly, "has been one of the dark places of the earth." He was the only man of us who still followed the sea. The worst that could be said of him was that he did not represent his class. He was a seaman, but he was a wanderer, too. While most seamen lead, if one may so express it, a sedentary life, their minds are of the stay-at-home order, and their home is always with them, the ship, and so is their country, the sea. One ship is very much like another, and the sea is always the same. In the immutability of their surroundings, the foreign shores, the foreign faces, the changing immensity of life glide past, veiled not by a sense of mystery, but by a slightly disdainful ignorance. For there is nothing mysterious to a seaman, unless it be the sea itself, which is the mistress of his existence, and as inscrutable as destiny. For the rest, after his hours of work, a casual stroll or a casual spree on shore suffices to unfold for him the secret of a whole continent, and generally he finds the secret not worth knowing. The yarns of seamen have an effective simplicity, the whole meaning of which lies within the shell of a cracked nut. But as has been said, Marlowe was not typical, if his propensity to spin yarns be accepted, and to him the meaning of an episode was not inside like a kernel, but outside, enveloping the tale which brought it out only as a glow brings out a haze, in the likeness of one of these misty halos that sometimes are made visible by the spectral illumination of moonshine. His remark did not seem at all surprising. It was just like Marlowe. It was accepted in silence. No one took the trouble to grunt even. And presently he said, very slow, "I was thinking of very old times, when the Romans first came here. 1900 years ago, the other day. Light came out of this river since, you say nights, yes, but it is like a running blaze on a plain, like a flash of lightning in the clouds. We live in the flicker. May it last as long as the old earth keeps rolling. But darkness was here yesterday."
We've just heard The Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. The Sheltering Sky by Paul Bowles is a landmark of 20th century literature, a novel of existential despair that examines the limits of humanity when it touches the emptiness of the desert. Academy Award winner Jennifer Connelly performs the story of three American travelers, a married couple and their friend, as they find themselves adrift in the cities and deserts of North Africa after World War II. Along the walkabout, their ignorance of the dangers that surrounds them peels back the veneer of their lives. The author's life as an expat in Morocco drew his rendering of the desert, which becomes a cruel, unforgiving character in the novel. Paul Bowles' writing is so extraordinary, so special, Connelly comments. The landscapes are magical, the characters are questioning so much. It's haunting in a very beautiful way.
On the terrace of the Café Decmal Noiseau, a few Arabs sat drinking mineral water. Only their fezes of varying shades of red distinguished them from the rest of the population of the port. Their European clothes were worn and gray. It would have been hard to tell what the cut of any garment had been originally. The nearly naked shoeshine boys squatted on their boxes looking down at the pavement, without the energy to wave away the flies that crawled over their faces. Inside the cafe, the air was cooler but without movement, and it smelled of stale wine and urine. At the table in the darkest corner sat three Americans, two young men and a girl. They conversed quietly, and in the manner of people who have all the time in the world for everything. One of the men, the thin one with a slightly wry, distraught face, was folding up some large multicolored maps he had spread out on the table a moment ago. His wife watched the meticulous movements he made with amusement and exasperation. Maps bored her, and he was always consulting them. Even during the short periods when their lives were stationary, which had been few enough since their marriage 12 years ago, he had only to see a map to begin studying it passionately, and then, often as not, he would begin to plan some new, impossible trip which sometimes, eventually, became a reality. He did not think of himself as a tourist. He was a traveler. The difference is partly one of time, he would explain. Whereas the tourist generally hurries back home at the end of a few weeks or months, the traveler, belonging no more to one place than to the next, moves slowly, over periods of years, from one part of the earth to another. Indeed, he would have found it difficult to tell, among the many places he had lived, precisely where it was he had felt most at home. Before the war, it had been Europe and the Near East. During the war, the West Indies and South America. And she had accompanied him without reiterating her complaints too often or too bitterly. At this point, they had crossed the Atlantic for the first time since 1939, with a great deal of luggage and the intention of keeping as far as possible from the places which had been touched by the war. For, as he claimed, another important difference between tourist and traveler is that the former accepts his own civilization without question. Not so the traveler, who compares it with the others and rejects those elements he finds not to his liking. And the war was one facet of the mechanized age he wanted to forget.
We've just heard The Sheltering Sky by Paul Bowles. Let's close today's show with a performance by Colin Firth, an actor I adore. I'm sure you'll enjoy his award-winning performance of Graham Greene's The End of the Affair. The title won Audiobook of the Year in 2013 and was a nominee for Best Solo Narration. The End of the Affair, set in London during and just after World War II, is the story of a flourishing love affair between Maurice Bendix and Sarah Miles. After a violent episode at Maurice's apartment, Sarah suddenly and without explanation breaks off the affair. Green pens an intimate story about what actually constitutes love.
A story has no beginning or end. Arbitrarily, one chooses that moment of experience from which to look back or from which to look ahead. I say one chooses with the inaccurate pride of a professional writer who, when he has been seriously noted at all, has been praised for his technical ability. But do I, in fact, of my own will, choose that black, wet January night on the Common in 1946? The sight of Henry Miles slanting across the wide river of rain? Or did these images choose me? It is convenient, it is correct, according to the rules of my craft, to begin just there. But if I had believed then in a god, I could also have believed in a hand plucking at my elbow, a suggestion, speak to him. He hasn't seen you yet. For why should I have spoken to him? If hate is not too large a term to use in relation to any human being, I hated Henry. I hated his wife, Sarah, too. And he, I suppose, came soon after the events of that evening to hate me, as he surely at times must have hated his wife and that other, in whom in those days we were lucky enough not to believe. So this is a record of hate, far more than of love. And if I come to say anything in favor of Henry and Sarah, I can be trusted. I am writing against the bias because it is my professional pride to prefer the near truth even to the expression of my near hate. It was strange to see Henry out on such a night. He liked his comfort, and after all, or so I thought, he had Sarah. To me, comfort is like the wrong memory at the wrong place or time. If one is lonely, one prefers discomfort. There was too much comfort even in the bed sitting room I had at the south side of the Common, in the relics of other people's furniture. I thought I would go for a walk through the rain and have a drink at the local. The little crowded hall was full of strangers' hats and coats, and I took somebody else's umbrella by accident. The man on the second floor had friends in. Then I closed the stained glass door behind me and made my way carefully down the steps that had been blasted in 1944 and never repaired. I had reason to remember the occasion and how the stained glass, tough and ugly and Victorian, stood up to the shock as our grandfathers themselves would have done. Directly I began to cross the common, I realized I had the wrong umbrella, for it sprang a leak and the rain ran down under my Macintosh collar. And then it was I saw Henry. I could so easily have avoided him. He had no umbrella, and in the light of the lamp I could see his eyes were blinded with the rain. The black, leafless trees gave no protection. They stood around like broken water pipes, and the rain dripped off his stiff, dark hat and ran in streams down his black civil servant's overcoat. If I had walked straight by him, he wouldn't have seen me, and I could have made certain by stepping 2 feet off the pavement. But I said, "Henry, you're almost a stranger," and saw his eyes light up as though we were old friends. "Bendrix," he said, with affection. And yet the world would have said he had the reasons for hate, not me. "What are you up to, Henry, in the rain?" There are men whom one has an irresistible desire to tease, men whose virtues one doesn't share. He said evasively, "Oh, I wanted a bit of air." And during a sudden blast of wind and rain, he just caught his hat in time from being whirled away towards the north side. "How's Sarah?" I asked, because it might have seemed odd if I hadn't. Though nothing would have delighted me more than to have heard that she was sick, unhappy, dying. I imagined in those days that any suffering she underwent would lighten mine, and if she were dead, I could be free. I would no longer imagine all the things one does imagine under my ignoble circumstances. I could even like poor silly Henry, I thought, if Sarah were dead.
We've just heard The End of the Affair by Graham Greene. Readers, these incredible performances are why we are all so devoted to audiobooks. Many times I've sat in my car in parking lots, unwilling to stop listening, even though I'd arrived at my destination. For more titles worthy of a listen, be sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.